We are truly honored today to have the co-directors of the Center for 21st Century Security and Intelligence here with us at a crucial time in American foreign policy. I hope you've had the opportunity to absorb the bios that are on the screens. In fact, we really needed extensions because they have such long, impressive bios. But we cut and pasted what we thought were the key issues. And I want you to understand that they show us exactly the scope of foreign policy issues that they are handling on a regular basis and that they will be sharing with us today and hopefully also with the incoming administration. We welcome General John Allen here today, and surely you can see that his military career is not only most impressive, but far-reaching in scope. And many of the questions we'll ask him today will reflect the scope of that experience. I was deeply honored to meet General Allen in Afghanistan, and I hope all of you will not only join me in welcoming him now, but thanking him for his outstanding service to our country, General Allen. Thank you, John. Now to Dr. Michael O'Hanlon, the other half of this great team at Brookings, a favorite here at the podium in Naples. I believe this is your fourth presentation to us, Mike, a sure indication that your scholarship continues to give us a great deal of wonderful information. Dr. O'Hanlon is a prolific writer, director of research for the Foreign Policy Program at Brookings, and an adjunct professor at many of our fine universities. He's a favorite of the press. That's a very unique quality today. Also of radio and television, and his record of more than 3,000 interviews since 9/11 suggests his input is well appreciated. I want to personally thank him for many Sunday mornings with a cup of coffee and C-SPAN that I have enjoyed over these years. And I want to also apologize because he brought his family here to enjoy the beach. And guess what you did for him? You dropped the temperatures. That's really terrible. Mike, that sounds like an idea for an encore. And welcome again to you, Mike O'Hanlon. Part of the incoming administration's plan to, quote, make America great again includes restoring our military capability and readiness to 100%. Defense Secretary Carter recently testified to the Senate Armed Services Committee on the proposed budget for 2017. He noted that while Russia, China, North Korea, Iran, and ISIS all pose threats, the biggest danger to U.S. national security would be an underfunded budget as we face those military challenges. General Allen, based on your experience in the region, you have stressed the need to, quote, forge an enduring partnership with Afghanistan in pursuit of common strategic interests and establish a key front in a generational conflict against violent extremists across the greater Middle East. Is Afghanistan a crucial pillar of America's global anti-terror campaign? And is it a needed contributor to regional stability?
Well, first, Mamie, thanks very much for the invitation to join you all today. And ladies and gentlemen, it is a great honor to be with you here and to have the opportunity to speak with you and to get to know you a bit. And I want to thank you for the many contributions that you all have made to the prosperity and the national security of the United States of America. And it's an honor to be before you today and to talk about these important subjects. Obviously, Afghanistan is an important topic to me. I was the commander there for almost 19 months during a pretty tough time. It shouldn't be difficult to create what I would consider almost the genealogical relationship between Afghanistan today and Afghanistan that was the platform from which al-Qaeda would launch the worst terrorist attack on American soil that we've ever faced, and one of the worst terrorist attacks in history. So with that in mind, we obviously went to great lengths over a long war to to try to change Afghanistan to prevent it from being a platform for continued terrorist activity, but also to prevent it from being a platform that could threaten American interests at home in the United States and our allies. That objective remains. It's an important objective, not just because we want to eliminate these platforms for terrorist activity, but because we want Afghanistan to become an example of a country in that part of the world that can both govern itself, secure itself, and ultimately have a viable economy in a way that makes it a meaningful and contributing member of the community of nations. Now, Afghanistan is surrounded by partners that are real problems, Iran to the west, Pakistan to the east, the former Soviet republics to the north. And it's been a long, hard slog for us to deal with the Taliban, to deal with al-Qaeda, which is in Afghanistan, but also to build the capacity for Afghanistan to secure itself. So, sorry for the long answer. Afghanistan is important as a platform for stability in that region. It is important to the long-term stability of Pakistan, which on any given day ought to be something we spend a lot of time worrying about. And it is a viable and, I think, a valuable ally to the United States, both in terms of our counterterrorism strategy, but more broadly the strategy that we're pursuing that can deal with the issue of the radicalization of millions and millions of people around the world that pushes them into the arms of extremists. And while the news reports are sometimes a bit hard on us, I'm here to tell you that the accomplishments of your magnificent young men and women in uniform and our diplomats and our intelligence professionals in Afghanistan deserve the highest acclaim, because from where we were in the latter part of 2001 to where we are today, while, yes, Afghanistan still has its share of problems, we have come a very long way, and now is not the time to give up on this place, because we are on the verge of being successful over the long term. And I obviously would defer to my dear friend and great colleague, Mike, on this if he has any additional thoughts.
Mike, your recent book, The Future of Land Warfare, refutes the, quote, supposed obsolescence of large-scale ground combat. You recommend that the Army should stay around 1 million soldiers overall, and that they should have the capability to wage one major all-out regional battle while contributing substantially to two multi-year multilateral operations. Put that in English for the rest of us.
Thank you, Mimi. Thank you, everyone. It's wonderful to see you, and it's a real honor to be here with my good friend, General John Allen, who has done so much for this country. I am going to pick up on Afghanistan, but not to, and I'll get back to this question. I'll do it all briefly, but I want to do the following. I want to explain a little bit about what happened in those 19 months that General Allen was in command, just to underscore how much my good friend accomplished, because he began that when our mutual friend, General Dave Petraeus, had finished his 12 months in sort of surprise command, as you'll recall, from the summer of 2010 through early summer of 2011 before being chosen for CIA director. And I think General John could have been forgiven for saying to General Dave, well, thanks a lot. You got all the 100,000 forces during your year here. And now the minute I arrive, I have to start cutting them before the job is done. So in his 19 months, he started with that 100,000 U.S. troop total, went down to 68,000 by the following summer, and then prepared the way for another round of reductions. And, of course, the battle wasn't won in any of these sectors, so what he had to do was figure out how to hand off the job as much as possible to the Afghans when their army and police weren't yet quite ready for the job, but the timelines were forced and accelerated as much by American politics and Afghan politics as by anything. And speaking of Afghan politics, he had to deal with President Karzai, who at this point had become fairly irascible, as I think most of us would remember. And it wasn't because of anything that General John did, but Karzai at this point was showing the fatigue and signs of being in a presidency in a country that was struggling for a long time. He was developing conspiracy theories in his own mind about why it was taking so long. He was trying to keep a very disparate coalition together. I'm trying to paint a fairly neutral picture of Karzai. I think he's a very talented but also very flawed individual, but he had to be partnered with. And General Allen, as well as our ambassador in Afghanistan at the time, had to do that. So simultaneously, fighting the war, downsizing the mission, transferring the U.S. and NATO roles to a assistance mission, and managing Karzai, all in that 19-month period. It still boggles my mind how much was accomplished and how much he had to do. So it should be no surprise, however, because one more quick story on General Allen, which is, and this is very quick, but he was the first Marine that the U.S. Navy ever asked to be the so-called Commandant of the Midshipmen at Annapolis. Now, just think about that for a minute. This is a Marine, and the Navy put him in charge of sailors and their education, entrusting the future of the U.S. Navy to a Marine. I'm saying it several times, so you can begin to grapple with the significance of this.
Well, and, my classmates called it the great experiment.
So Mimi, thank you for your question. I'm just going to give one other. When I say that the Army should be about 1 million soldiers, that's active and reserve and National Guard combined, complemented by a Marine Corps of about 180,000 active and another 40,000. So even when you add it all up, it's still only about 1.25 million American forces who are capable of ground operations. Of course, the Marines are also a naval and expeditionary force. I wouldn't want to call them just a ground force, especially when I'm within choking range of a Marine just to my right. So I'm not trying to say the Marines are only a ground force, but this is by the standards of history, by the standards of international militaries, and certainly relative to the size of the problems we could face, this is a pretty modest ground force. It's not too different from where we are today. But there had been a lot of talk in the second Obama term of cutting the Army substantially more. And I was trying to push back against that. And just to give you, so when I say one war plus two smaller missions, I'm thinking a pretty modest, plausible worst case is to have to fight another Korean War or another big war in the Middle East, which is an acute threat to an American ally or interest, while simultaneously managing a couple of messy operations of sort of the Bosnia variety, or now what Afghanistan has become. Afghanistan is no longer a major American combat operation. There's still combat. We are primarily in support, but you know that's the kind of mission I have in mind when I'm thinking of these two smaller but still important missions. And I think a standard that says we should be able to win one war outright with relatively modest allied support, because we can't necessarily count on faraway allies if it's an acute, quick, urgent demand. But then two smaller operations that do involve allies that are more in the mold of peacekeeping, stabilization, you know, use your favorite word, probably don't use nation building because most people don't like that word, but two smaller, prolonged, multilateral missions of the type that we've often seen in the last 20 or 30 years. To me, that's a modest requirement for what the ground forces of the United States should be able to do. And if I do the math on what I think that probably requires, recognizing that you can never know what war might actually happen, so all this math is pretty rough, then I wind up with the requirement of roughly 1 million soldiers.
Thank you, Mike. Recently, the president-elect on MSNBC referred to the issue of nuclear arms, saying, quote, "Let it be an arms race." Joseph Cirincione of the Plowshares Fund called that a very dangerous policy that would promote a race between India, Pakistan, and China to increase the number of their warheads. He also noted that Russia had been steadily updating its stockpile while the U.S. is behind by approximately 400 warheads. Do you both believe we are facing a nuclear escalation?
Well, I hope not. That's a reckless statement, frankly. And my concerns are, number one, we have worked so hard as a nation with our partners on the Non-Proliferation Treaty to contain the spread of nuclear weapons. And so any comments that would seem to imply that we want to open that whole chapter once again for the acquisition of large standing nuclear arsenals, not just by members of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, but other states, which as they see us potentially rearming and other states then arming because we are, will then decide that it's in their best interest to begin nuclear weapons programs with the objective of achieving nuclear capabilities. Look, we have gone to great lengths to contain the spread of nuclear weapons. And even under our very best occasion, we know from my own experience dealing with Daesh the Islamic State, sorry, the Arabic acronym is Daesh, with dealing with the Islamic State and with Al-Qaeda, that given their opportunities, they will look for weapons of mass destruction and will look for some form of a nuclear capability, whether that's a dirty bomb or some form of an explosive device. So we can't afford a nuclear arms race. We could technically afford it in a fiscal sense. But the forces of competition and the forces that of attempting to create nuclear superiority that would be unleashed by that decision would, I think, work very much to our disadvantage and very much to the disadvantage of the stability that has been achieved by the American-developed system of international order, a part of which has been the Non-Proliferation Treaty and the limitation of nuclear weapons. You know, whether they've got 400 warheads short or 400 warheads too many, that's an irrelevant number, really. In the end, the destructive capacity of the United States nuclear arsenal and the capacity of our triad system, which is our land-based ballistic missiles, our bomber fleet, and our submarine-launched ballistic missiles, that is a very sophisticated, very capable nuclear capability, which guarantees our enemies that if they were to launch a first strike, surprise first strike on the United States, they wouldn't get everything. We would have enough capacity in the aftermath to guarantee them that we would destroy them in a second strike. So as long as that triad remains secure, the issue of whether there's 400 too many or 400 too few warheads is irrelevant. The one thing we do need to think about is the modernization of our nuclear deterrent, the modernization of our nuclear command and control, and the modernization of our weapon systems. And given that the Russians have recently proclaimed a doctrine of escalating to de-escalate, meaning they are prepared in the event of a conflict with NATO or us to escalate in the use of nuclear weapons in order to de-escalate the conflict, that should drive us to be thinking very seriously about whether our nuclear deterrent is in peak form in terms of modernization, not necessarily in numbers of warheads. We should seek in every possible way to preclude an arms race and to preclude unleashing the forces that will cause people more broadly around the planet to want to have possessed nuclear weapons.
Mike, a comment?
I'll be brief. I think General John was brilliant and comprehensive in that answer. I'll just make a very small observation that a man many of us know and that we've admired for many years, the great Dr. Bill Perry, former Secretary of Defense, has, as many of you know, been on a recent campaign as he reaches the tender age of 89 years old to restore America's heightened sense of some trepidation about where the nuclear weapons balances are still today. And even though they are down by about 75% from their peak levels, it's still close to 5,000 warheads for both the United States, or I should say each, the United States and Russia, and they're still essentially on hair trigger alert. And now we see them becoming part of the normal currency of how the United States and Russia are dealing with each other again, mostly because of Vladimir Putin, although we have to think hard about what we can do differently to change the dynamic. So I think you're coming back later to Russia, and I will come back later to Russia. If I'm going to try to say something nice about Mr. Trump in these opening minutes, I will say the following, that I think there is, if his sentiment about wanting to restore improved relations with Russia is done with open eyes about the nature of the challenge and is done with an awareness of all the adventurism and shenanigans that Vladimir Putin is pursuing around the world, then I welcome it. In other words, if it's not a naive hope, because I think that trying to tone down the tension in U.S.-Russia relations is a worthy sentiment. The question is how. Both George W. Bush and Barack Obama also entered the White House hoping to have a good relationship with Vladimir Putin. They were both disappointed. So the question is not so much for me whether Mr. Trump is right to have that sentiment. I'm trying to wish him well with that sentiment. The question is, how do you build a sustainable U.S.-Russia interaction which can reduce a number of dangers, including the nuclear one?
Quote, facing the rising danger, narrowing options, and hard choices of dealing with a nuclear-armed North Korea, Evans Revere of the Albright Stonebridge Group states that North Korea's threats to use these weapons will soon present the president-elect with an enormous challenge. He suggests that the United States and its allies and partners should make North Korea choose between nuclear weapons and survival. Have we reached that step, all others having failed? General John.
I had the honor a few years ago to participate in something called the Six-Party Talks, which was, the whole term is Six-Party Talks for the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. And the Chinese hosted the talks, and we would go to Beijing, and we sat in a great big circle, and right here was the North Korean delegation, which caused my skin to crawl most of the time. I think we need to all be realistic about the choice of survival or nuclear weapons to the North Koreans. We have seen that the North Korean regime, in this case Kim Jong-un, has as his father did and his grandfather did, Kim Jong-il and Kim Il-sung, demonstrated enormous capacity to dig in behind a bad decision and endure enormous adversity and inflict enormous privation upon the population of North Korea. So I think it's a false choice. You survive or you give up nuclear weapons, because the first thing I would say, and probably there are intelligence professionals in this audience who knows that we really don't know that much about the North Korean nuclear program, both in terms of its the numbers of warheads and where they are. And so we got to be very, very careful about, we'll have to defend ourselves if we're forced to do so, and we shouldn't shrink from that, and we have the war plans to do that in a variety of ways. But to create a false choice that causes the North Koreans to dig in even deeper behind the policy of the possession of nuclear weapons, and it's not just a nuclear weapons policy, it is the development of the capacity to deliver that nuclear weapon, which ought to be a concern for us. I think Mike may want to talk about it, but for me, the first indicator for us that we will not tolerate a North Korea that can produce a delivery system that can deliver a weapon on American territory is how we'll deal with the advertised intent by Kim Jong-un to launch a intercontinental ballistic missile that can reach the United States. That is something over which we should be deeply concerned. I know the president-elect has tweeted about that. Not going to happen, I think he said. And there are ways that we can prevent that. But North Korea is a wild card in the region. We should all be very proud of the fact that Northeast Asia has existed at peace largely since the Korean War, in which the United States endured enormous privation and casualties, and we've had the better part of a division-sized strength there today. The Korean economy, the Korean nation has emerged, South Korean nation has emerged as a glowing example of success. Now, they got big political problems right now, but that comes and goes with most countries, and Japan as well. And China has benefited from the stability of the American presence in that region. And so we need to be very careful about permitting that stability and that presence to be undermined by the continuing development of nuclear weapons and their delivery systems by the North Koreans. And, of course, we've now putting missile defense capabilities into the region to defend South Korea and Japan from a launch from North Korea. We have the capacity to do that. Our missile defense capabilities are very sophisticated. Chinese are unhappy about it because they think our ulterior motive really is to compromise their nuclear deterrent. We've assured them that it isn't, and I think they recognize that as Kim Jong-un becomes more bellicose, as he becomes more intent and threatening of the United States, we're going to have to defend ourselves, and it's in China's interest to be helpful to us in that regard. And I'll stop there and let Mike take.
Yeah, huge challenge, and General John, as usual, has done a great job. I would add a couple of points. One is that Evans Revere, I thought, laid out very well in this essay, which I actually asked him to write for this project that we were doing at Brookings, and I had the honor of coordinating it across all our different research programs. I was thrilled to have Evans' very well-thought-through articulation of this get-tough policy. But, of course, when Evans says, and when you summarize with that soundbite, Mimi, that we should force the North Koreans to choose between survival and nuclear weapons, well, the implied premise is without at the same time having to go to war ourselves and see South Korea obliterated along the way. So we're looking for a way to squeeze North Korea rather than fight North Korea, presumably. And if you then develop the argument, as Evans does, what he says is we want China, which has become the only real economic lifeline to the North Koreans, to cut off that lifeline or to threaten to cut off that lifeline as a way to create leverage in the denuclearization talks. Well, of course, that means that China has to either agree, which they've been resisting now for decades because we've been trying to deal with the North Korean nuclear program for more than two decades, or we have to have enough leverage over China to force them to do it somehow. At the same time, we're also gearing up for a serious economic challenge to China from the Trump administration. And by the way, that part I'm a little more sympathetic to. But I think to pile on a lot of separate issues, you know, the future of Taiwan, the future of U.S.-China economic relations, North Korea policy, and to and the South China Sea, and to simultaneously try to pressure China hard on all of these does not sound to me very promising. So in the end, I admire Evan's article, and I think if there are a couple more North Korean provocations, there's a chance that we might get the Chinese to do this. But so far, the Chinese haven't really done it, even after five North Korean nuclear tests and a number of other such unacceptable actions. So I think we have to also consider another approach, which is, and you know, this is a very hard one as well, and General John and those at lunch who were with us, Mimi, you've heard me mention this already today, but the basic idea would be, should we stop trying to pursue complete North Korean denuclearization as the first goal of the first negotiated settlement, and should we instead go for an interim deal that tries to freeze their development of nuclear weapons and long-range missiles? And if we can make that verifiable, which is very hard, but if we can make that verifiable, could we then relax some of the existing sanctions on North Korea as an interim agreement? I think we have to give that option some serious consideration, because as we sit here and speak, North Korea is probably developing a new bomb every season or so, probably three, four, five a year. That's the best guess that I've seen of, I mean, who knows, but that seems to be about what they're able to produce right now. And so the strategy of being patient in negotiations is not really working, and I'm willing to consider an interim deal with more modest goals in the first instance.
Well, you've discussed some of the points that Evans made also in his article, and I guess the only thing I would add to that, since you've answered some of my question now, is to say that the Chinese foreign minister reportedly used a call to his Japanese counterpart conveying opposition to unilateral sanctions on North Korea. And China also complains that the U.S. is, quote, using North Korea and the issue of nuclear as a pretext to enhance U.S. regional military deployments aimed at China. Should the U.S. adopt a more robust approach from that standpoint?
Well, I alluded to that in the answer on the missile defense issues, and I think we should. The Chinese, the North Koreans don't just have or are not just pursuing a delivery system that's an intercontinental ballistic missile. They have a whole series of missiles that can threaten South Korea and Japan. And many people don't know this, but we have five defense treaties in East Asia. These are go-to-war treaties where the United States will go to war to defend our allies. And it's South Korea, Japan, Thailand, the Philippines, and Australia. And so when North Korea has, as it has done on a regular basis, threatened to bring about bring down the nuclear fire on the puppet regime of, as they call it, South Korea, or on Japan, and as they have become more muscular and more provocative, and they've been able to perfect the intermediate delivery systems that can reach South Korea and Japan, we have an obligation to defend shy of the requirement to go to nuclear war. And that's what deploying our missile defense curtain into that region does for us. Now, as I said before, the Chinese have accused us of seeking to create a missile defense regime in Northeast Asia that compromises their nuclear deterrent. Our view is that's not, in fact, the case. You have to recognize that this is a legitimate effort by the United States to support two treaty allies, and we acknowledge the Chinese nuclear deterrent. We've had a relationship with them on this issue for a long period of time, and they're just going to have to trust us that it is far more likely that we would employ this missile defense capability to defend our treaty allies against a North Korean employment of ballistic missiles than it would ever be to compromise the Chinese nuclear deterrent and leave them, for all intents and purposes, with no nuclear capability vis-a-vis the United States. And it's a very complex subject. It's a very complex conversation. But we've tried to make the point over and over again to the Chinese, don't worry about the American missile defense capability. It's oriented on the North Koreans in order to defend our treaty partners.
Okay. Shifting geography a little bit, General Allen, at the end of October, you wrote eloquently of the, quote, unspeakable medieval-style brutality that Assad has practiced against his people. You say, quote, the world will not forgive us for our inaction. Your hope for an intervention to save Aleppo did not occur, and today finds Russia, Turkey, and Iran in leadership roles with the United States, the outsider. Do we still have a dog in this fight?
Well, the immediate answer is yes. If for no other reason, we've got to be concerned about this at a humanitarian level. Syria is a catastrophe, a humanitarian catastrophe. I don't know the exact number, but I believe we have now passed the number of 500,000 dead in this conflict. 500,000. And, you know, I organized and we sort of took to war the global coalition to defeat Daesh, ISIL. ISIL's killed many Syrians, but the vast majority of the Syrians who died in this war were killed by the regime and more recently killed by the Russians with their Iranian supporters and allies and Hezbollah out of Lebanon and other elements. So yes, we should have a dog in this fight if for no other reason, if we can do something to mitigate and to end the suffering of the Syrian people, we should pull out all stops. Sadly, we have very few policy options, frankly, remaining to us. Many of you remember, some of you probably were involved in the policy debate that we had around 2012 about whether we should arm the Free Syrian Army, which has largely ceased to exist because they've either defected to another group that was being armed by someone. We chose not to. They're now being armed by another group of some form or another, or they've been wiped out. And so when I had the opportunity to first confront in a previous position the American policy in Syria, what I saw was a strategy to defeat ISIL, a political objective to effect a policy or a political change in Damascus that would move Bashar al-Assad along, an intent to empower the moderate Syrian opposition, but not with arms, and no intent at all to deal with the other elephant in the room, which was an organization called Jabhat al-Nusra, now known as Jabhat al-Fatah, which is al-Qaeda. So our sort of patchwork policy in Syria wasn't enough to defeat Daesh. It wasn't enough to move Bashar al-Assad along. It wasn't enough to help the moderate Syrians to defend themselves from Daesh or from the regime or to be political players in the outcome, and it left al-Qaeda alone. So eventually the Russians intervened. They recognized that the United States wasn't going to up its game more than we do today, and they intervened. And that precipitated a very large number of both civilian casualties and another wave of refugees. I think many of you are aware that the first wave of refugees coming out of Syria has probably changed Europe forever. 1 million more or 2 million refugees into Europe, and Europe will be changed forever. So Syria isn't just a national conflict. It is a regional conflict. It is an international conflict, and the United States has an obligation to be interested first in ending the humanitarian catastrophe that is Syria today and trying to have some viable role in the negotiating process that can move Bashar al-Assad along. But we have virtually no options that we can exercise now. And, I'll just stop there.
And he's put a lot of time into this, as you know, as the envoy for fighting ISIS and organizing the coalition against it. A couple of weeks ago, I tried to write an op-ed. It was in the Wall Street Journal, in which I tried to take what President-elect Trump has said about Syria to combine with recent battlefield dynamics, especially the fall of Aleppo, and just figure out the best path or maybe the least bad path forward that I could articulate. And I think the days of, as General Allen just said, you know, the days of having enough American leverage to do very much maybe never even really existed in this conflict, and they probably are largely gone, especially with Mr. Trump coming in and wanting to cooperate more with Putin and even tolerate Assad in the interest of defeating ISIS and al-Qaeda. And one quick point, I was in Jordan the week after the U.S. presidential election. I have to acknowledge that there were some high-level Jordanian officials who were willing to take Trump's concepts and view them as a potential basis for an improved policy, because they're very frustrated with where we are now. And they don't feel that President Obama has done a great job on this issue. So on the one hand, there was some open-mindedness to a new path forward, even within the framework of what Mr. Trump has said. On the other hand, Mr. Trump doesn't seem to have a whole lot more figured out yet, except that he wants to defeat ISIS and al-Qaeda, presumably. The problem is that to do that, while you're depending on Assad and Russia and Putin as your fighting mechanism for that defeat, you guarantee that the Sunni Muslim part of Syria, which is two-thirds of the population, will be forever embittered against this effort and against the current administration in Syria for the very reason that General Allen just said, that they've got the blood of so many hundreds of thousands of Syrians on their hands, and half of the Syrian pre-war population has been displaced from their original homes. So I don't think you can ask the Sunnis in Syria, whether they're Arab or Kurd, to live under Assad, and yet we don't have the means to push Assad out, so we're in a catch-22. So the only thing I can think of, and I won't elaborate on all the details, but the only thing I can think of is some kind of an equivalent of an Iraqi Kurdistan where you have autonomy for most of the Sunni Muslims. And as long as Assad is president, you guarantee that autonomy. And you may have to deploy an international peacekeeping force if you can ever negotiate this and get a signed deal. And then you have to apply leverage in the form of economic aid and reconstruction assistance to these autonomous areas. And Assad doesn't get any of that money as long as he's still president of Syria. So we acknowledge that we don't have the means to push him out immediately, but we retain the leverage that if he wants to rebuild Damascus and Aleppo and Homs and Hama and other areas of the country that he controls, if he wants to access that international reconstruction assistance, he's going to have to figure out a path to step down. That's the best I can do at a policy. Obviously, that's very hard to negotiate, but at least it recognizes the realities that we don't have the leverage now to push Assad out of power on our own.
Mike, along those lines, you say in your vision of how warfare will be, land warfare will be in the future, is Syria an example of that sort of one major all-out regional battle? Is that the way this is going to end up finally getting solved? Or is the Middle East becoming just a much larger theater overall?
Well, I don't think anybody, my guess is nobody in this room, and by the way, it's an amazing room and an amazing group of people, so thanks to all of you and to Mimi, and it's just such a pleasure to be here, and what a turnout and what a group of amazing Americans, as General Allen said before. My guess is there are very few people in this room who'd be willing to see another 100,000 U.S. troop deployment to yet another Middle Eastern country. I think that part President Obama got right, but I've heard, not from him, but from the grapevine otherwise, that President Obama would sort of use this straw man of a huge invasion as an argument against various other more modest means of stepping up our involvement in Syria. And that was part of how he slowed any kind of a response. Well, here we are at the end of his 8 years. I think it's been a reasonably good foreign policy in many parts of the world, but on this issue, I think it's been a failure. And I don't think it's very plausible to look at this issue and claim that it's anything but a failure at the moment. And I think we're going to have to use more force in certain ways. Now, at least that's what I was arguing until November 8th. On November 8th, we got a president-elect who says he wants to do perhaps even less in Syria in the way of putting pressure on Assad or opposing Russia's equities. And so at this point, the concept that I was articulating a moment ago would involve, hypothetically, a U.S. role in a peacekeeping force that might be, you know, the entire force might be 20 or 30 or 40,000 people. Maybe our role is 5 or 10,000. That's already going to be more than many Americans would prefer. And I think there would be casualties for this kind of an operation because there are going to be some leftover elements of extremists under any scenario that I can imagine. But that's the kind of future American mission that I think we could find ourselves in Syria. Because frankly, again, I think the vision I laid out may be difficult to achieve. It may not be ideal. But to me, it is the only semi-acceptable and semi-practical vision for a future Syria that I could imagine right now. And it does require some degree of an international peacekeeping force to help protect those autonomous areas where people, if they're not given their own ability to control their own lives, they're going to keep fighting Assad. Because whatever his potential as a reformer before 2011, he is now, in their eyes, a mass murderer of their people. So I can't see the Sunnis of Syria ever accepting Assad again.
Let me just jump in here as well. A couple of things. You know, we've had this, this, as Mike said, the comments by the president-elect that he wants to cooperate with the Russians to deal with the Islamic State. Dealing with the Islamic State doesn't solve the Syrian problem. The Syrian problem is the Russian support to Bashar al-Assad, who's been largely responsible for the killing of hundreds of thousands of his own people. And Mike just said something very important. On any given day, as this war labored on roughly around 2013, 2014, there were over 1,000 different armed groups on the ground fighting in Syria. Some of them were willing to line up with us. Some of them ultimately were absorbed by the Islamic State. Many of them were supported by Gulf partners of ours. Many of them ultimately ended up as Islamist or jihadi fighting forces, like Jabhat al-Nusra, as I said. And so the recent cessation of hostilities that was proclaimed, whereby Bashar al-Assad and Putin and Erdogan were going to protect the cessation of hostilities and to begin negotiations in Kazakhstan with Syrian opposition forces, they don't even know what Syrian opposition forces are coming. And it appears more and more that none of them are coming. And so the idea that this can be solved in the short term by defeating Daesh is not, in fact, correct. There are thousands, millions of Syrians ready to fight on who have nothing to do with Daesh, you know, who are willing to fight the Russians and the Syrians, Syrian leadership. And this is the challenge that we have.
Well, let's talk about Vladimir Putin and the rebirth under his leadership of the Russian Empire, quote unquote. At the moment, he is either engaged in or threatening approximately 1.8 million square miles west of Russia. I would like to ask both of you to comment on this very clever but truly dangerous strategist and the chess game that he's playing with our country, our psyche, and the incoming administration. It'll only take about 20 or 30 minutes each.
We'll have seasickness bags available.
I'll just say two things to start, and then I know General Allen's got a lot of... And by the way, it's interesting to remember back in his command in Afghanistan, and he was telling some of the story over lunch, there was a period of time when the Pakistanis cut off access to logistics lines to get supplies into this huge NATO force. And at that time, General Allen had to take advantage of the so-called Northern Distribution Network, which partly involved Russian acquiescence, to get supplies into the forces. And he built up even greater inventory at the end of the Pakistani cutoff than they had at the beginning, which is an amazing accomplishment. Also, of course, we did have Russian help in the Iran sanctions effort. Whether you like the Iran deal that ensued or not, the strategy that got us to be in a position to have a deal was a bipartisan, bicameral strategy that we conducted and conceptualized with our European friends, and it relied on cooperation with Russia as well. So we have to find a way to defuse as many of the possible challenges as we can with Russia while also being as firm as we need to be in a given situation. So the first point I want to make is that I hope Donald Trump will continue the so-called European Reassurance Initiative. Some of you are, I'm sure, familiar with this, but NATO is now basically putting a battalion permanently in Estonia, another battalion permanently in Latvia, a third in Lithuania, and then a fourth, the U.S.-led one, in Poland, with a little bit more than that in the early period as we sort of await the arrival of all of these capabilities. Now, some people in this room will know better than I that a battalion is impressive sounding, but it's about 800 people. So, you know, and you can reinforce it and throw in a little bit of combat aviation and intelligence, and so maybe it's 1,200 now. The point is we're trying to deter the entire Russian army of several hundred thousand from moving into NATO territory with the equivalent of the Baltic states' combined armies, which are about, I think, 25,000 strong between the three of them, and then another 5,000 total NATO troops. This, to me, is a minimal response in the era that we're living in now. It is a reinforced tripwire. It is not a robust forward defense. It is not even providing the capability for a rapid deployment of a robust forward defense. There are some additional equipment stocks that will be added. I think Hillary Clinton probably would have added even more, I'm guessing, because, again, what we've got is a minimal approach, a minimal requirement. I hope Donald Trump, even with his admittedly, you know, hopeful view of U.S.-Russian relations, which I'm not all against, I hope Trump will continue the European Reassurance Initiative. It took a lot of NATO bargaining to get us there, and I think it's the minimal way for NATO to send the message that thou shalt not mess with any NATO member state. That's my first key point. My second point is, having just said that, that I think every NATO member state is equally important, I don't think NATO should expand further to the east. And I don't think there's any potential prospect that it will. Right now we're in this, I find, and General Allen may not agree with me on this, so we'll look forward to his thoughts in a second, but I think we're in a very difficult situation now in regard to Ukraine and Georgia in particular, where Putin has deployed Russian military force aggressively in 2008 and then again since 2014, as everyone here knows. And we have these sort of promises to someday promise them to be in NATO, maybe. And that's sort of official policy, as squishy as I just made it sound. The Bush administration in 2008 could not persuade the rest of NATO to offer membership action plans to Ukraine or Georgia. These are the formal paths by which you join. So they got NATO to promise to someday promise to do a membership action plan. So it's sort of the worst of all worlds, in a sense, from the point of view of deterrence theory. We are telling Russia we are ambitious enough to want to include Ukraine and Georgia perhaps someday in NATO, but we're doing nothing to protect those countries right now, at least not with any kind of military capability in a direct military response. So to me, this underscores the dilemma we're in how we thought about East European security. I do not condone what Vladimir Putin's been doing in the least. I think he is a brutish thug. However, much of the reaction to NATO expansion within Russian politics was predictable, and it will go well beyond Putin. So I think we need to think about how we create a new security architecture for the currently neutral countries of Eastern Europe that will not require them to be in NATO to have their security guaranteed, and that will require a U.S.-Russian agreement, as well as their own agreement, of course, on how we do this. And so there are other countries in Europe that are neutral today, Austria, Switzerland, Sweden, and admittedly, with the exception of Sweden, they're not particularly exposed to the Russian threat. But we have to look into how we can create a proposal for a security architecture that would find some better way, some more promising near-term way, to get Ukraine and Georgia the security they need. They're not, by the way, they're not going to like this idea. And a lot of my fellow Americans don't like this concept. They say, I'm rewarding Putin for being a thug by promising that we won't bring Ukraine and Georgia into NATO. But my response is, right now, again, we're in this worst of all worlds where we're promising someday maybe we'll think about it, which is almost an invitation for Putin to muck around right now. And I think with the leverage we've got over Russia in the form of economic sanctions and other kinds of ways that, you know, Putin has to care about as well, I think we should explore the possibility of demanding that he get his forces off Ukraine and Georgia permanently and verifiably, as a condition for lifting of the sanctions that are currently in place, as well as a better U.S.-NATO-Russia relationship going forward. So those are just two components of the overall relationship, but I just wanted to mention those ideas.
That was a superb answer, Mike. Just a few other things. I think Vladimir Putin is intent on no less an objective and an outcome than to remake the world order. The world order that in this audience we all grew up in was purchased in the blood of our American and allied partners who defeated two horrendous regimes and empires, where we then, with our European allies, such as they were in the aftermath of World War II, created a bulwark for our defense. And the world order was an American world order. It's just that, and I'm not going to soft sell this. All of the ideas with respect to the economic world order, the political world order, the security world order was based upon the interaction of the community of nations. It was based upon a willingness for trade relationships and security relationships that would keep that world order. And I absolutely believe that Vladimir Putin is intent on remaking that world order into spheres of influence which minimizes the American influence in the world today, reduces the potential for Europe's unity, which accounts for why he's working so hard to undermine the elections of a number of our European partners, both through cyber operations and through influence operations. This doesn't bode well for our ability to have the kind of relationship that we want with Russia that I think the president-elect would like to have. I absolutely applaud the president-elect when he says we ought to have a good relationship with the Russians, or we ought to seek a relationship with the Russians. I don't think it can be good. I think it can be convenient. And we ought to be talking to our adversaries. When you don't talk to your adversaries, then miscalculation occurs, and actions can occur that can create a sequence of events which we can lose control over. But I do believe, and my going-in position on this, is that Vladimir Putin intends to remake the world order that was largely created by the United States in the aftermath of World War II and the Cold War into spheres of influence where he'll carve out his sphere and will operate within it and minimize U.S. influence in the Middle East, minimize U.S. influence in Europe, taking advantage of what he perceives from recent conversations and rhetoric that the United States is prepared to reduce its overseas presence and overseas influence. So we just need to be attentive to this. And Mike gave a marvelous prescription about what we can do in Europe. But about the time the Russians invaded, the Russians precipitated and helped the, let me remake my comment, where the Russians assisted in the destabilization of the eastern third of the Ukraine, another country was observing what was happening. And that country was China. And in the Global Times newspaper, an editorial by the Global Times said that we, the Chinese, observing what the Russians are doing in the Ukraine, ought to remember two things. One, that China has a role potentially in creating peaceful environments in the world today. But number two, this was important, the Chinese people should learn that once again the Russians have proven that power will dictate geopolitics. So when we talk about withdrawing our presence overseas, when we talk about minimizing our relationships in security and engagements, security treaties or security coalitions, it should not come as any surprise to us that both the Chinese in East Asia and the Russians in Europe are going to take advantage of that opportunity to increase their spheres of influence at the expense of American presence and ultimately to extend their influence over the countries of that region. Now, I spend a lot of time in the Balkans. I was not long ago, and I have been a number of times, in Montenegro. I don't know how many of you have been to Montenegro. It is the 29th member of NATO. It is coming into NATO. But I will tell you, the Russians were all over Montenegro with influence operations and cyber attacks intent on preventing that country from joining into NATO. And we should expect to see more of that in the future, not less of it. And we need to be prepared for it. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen, very much. We will open the floor now to questions.
What are the chances that Kim Jong-un will actually launch a missile that is capable of reaching this country with a nuclear warhead? What do you think the odds are of him doing that?
I think the odds of Kim Jong-un launching an ICBM not armed with a nuclear weapon, but capable of carrying one in theory, are high. I think he probably will do the test. And in fact, so I'm trying to fall back into the mode now, which is my normal mode at Brookings, of thinking through problems one at a time and trying to give my best advice to whoever might be listening or not listening. I guarantee it's not my wife, but hopefully it might be Mr. Trump on this one. And I want Mr. Trump to be successful, but I think the tweet about the ICBM launch was a big mistake, because I think the most likely result is going to be that North Korea will launch anyway. And in fact, that they'll be even more inclined to launch. And sometimes you want to make your points more quietly. So what Trump could have done, theoretically, this would have been an option, is to basically move some American ships into the waters in the Sea of Japan. These are ships equipped with a Navy Aegis radar system and standard missiles that are capable of missile defense intercept, and possibly even capable of intercept while the missile is on the launch or ascent phase or boost phase. And he could have quietly done that. And then he could have said quietly to Kim Jong-un, or through whatever good offices we have, I think through the Swiss, where I think Kim Jong-un went to prep school 5 or 10 years ago, could have said to Kim Jong-un, if you do launch this missile, we're going to try to shoot it down. And we have a pretty good chance of succeeding. And by the way, whether we would have wanted to say this or not, we also could preempt the missile while it's being fueled on the launch pad, because right now the ICBMs that North Korea is building, as I understand the technology, have to be, they're liquid fuel. They have to be erected and then filled up with fuel just before launch, which means we can see it happening because we know where the launch pads are and we have warning. So we can put combat aircraft into the sky, whether it's long-range stealthy aircraft or aircraft flying off of an aircraft carrier or from Japan, and we can actually demolish that ICBM before it's launched today. However, if we start getting into a big mano-a-mano with Kim Jong-un over this issue, then he's going to have an incentive to retaliate in some other way if we shoot down his ICBM, or to think of clever ways that make it harder for him to shoot down the ICBM, make it harder for us to shoot down the ICBM next time, maybe putting some astronauts on top of it or something. He doesn't really care if they live, but, you know, he's puts the onus on us to actually shoot the thing down, calls it a space launch vehicle, even though it's really not. Or accelerate, and this is what I really fear, accelerate the development of road mobile solid fuel ICBMs. That's what I don't want North Korea to have, because then we have no ability to preempt. Even in a war, even in an acute crisis, we will not, it'll be like the Scud missiles that Saddam had in 1991. We won't be able to find them in advance, and we won't be able to shoot them down. We'll have to hope that those 44 interceptors between California and Alaska can actually intercept in the mid-course or reentry phase. Here in Naples, Florida, you're relatively safer. But Kim can actually get it most of the country in theory with this ICBM. And I'm not sure if our Alaska-California system is yet good enough to hinge everything on that. So I'm a little nervous about seeing us give Kim an incentive to accelerate the development of road mobile solid fuel ICBMs. Therefore, I wish Mr. Trump hadn't made that tweet.
I'll just add, if they believe for a moment that it's our intention to effect regime change, their response could be very different than if it was just the normal raised tensions that we see from time to time when we do an exercise or B-2 bombers are flying somewhere nearby or B-1s or something like that. I don't think we really know how he would act if he truly became convinced that the U.S. was intent on regime change or were precipitating regime collapse. My guess is they would pull out all stops associated with how they would defend themselves. We just need to be very careful.